I say this to young athletes and I say this to established athletes. When you have created that foundation that's just unbreakable, then you can stand out there in the world's toughest, most pressure cooker stage, and you've taken away all the chaos. And so that's what I did. So I stood on the blocks. I looked at a sign on the right-hand side, which said Barcelona 1992 with the Olympic rings. I said to myself, this is your last time in this pool at this moment. I dove in and swam the most imperfect race. I've never swum a tuna butterfly like that. I think I gave my parents a heart attack. And I willed myself and like went back to the basics at the end of just get your arms over the water, get your arms over the water. And somehow, some way, I touched the wall first.
That's Summer Sanders describing her gold medal swim at the Barcelona Olympic Games. She's a decorated swimmer who spent years competing at the highest level of the sport, followed by a long career in television, advocating for and sharing the stories of other Olympic athletes. She knows, perhaps better than anyone, that Olympians are people too. They share some of the same fears, doubts, and insecurities as many of us. And Summer shares some powerful stories about how they still perform with those fears, even under immense pressure. You're listening to the Be a Good Wheel podcast, the show where we explore what it means to be a good wheel by digging into scientific research and personal stories about human potential and performance. I'm your host, Amber Pierce. Today, we get to pick the brain of Summer Sanders Schlope. When I was growing up, Summer Sanders was already a legend in the swimming world. A world champion, American record holder, Olympic medalist, and NC2A champion for Stanford University, she inspired me to set my sights on earning a swimming scholarship to Stanford. One of the things I loved about Summer was how honest and real she seemed, and how she was both a really nice person and a top competitor. She helped me see that it was not only possible, but perfectly okay to be both. At the age of 15, in her breakout performance, she came within a hundredth of a second of making the Olympic team in the 200-meter individual medley, a result that fueled her dream to return to the Olympic trials and make the team for the next Olympiad. The next year, she won silver in her first ever international event at the Pan Pacific Championships. She went on the following year to win two golds at Pan Pacific Championships in the 200-meter and 400-meter individual medley. The same year, she enrolled at Stanford University, where she would go on to win eight NC2A National Championship titles and help her team win the 1992 NC2A National Championships. She won back-to-back NC2A Swimmer of the Year awards and the Honda Sports Award for Swimming and Diving, recognizing her as the outstanding female college swimmer of the years 1991 and 1992. Also in 1991, she won gold, silver, and bronze at the World Championships in Perth, Australia, in the 200-meter butterfly, 200-meter individual medley, and 400-meter individual medley, respectively. At her next Olympic trials in 1992, she became the first woman since Hall of Famer Shirley Babashaw in 1976 to qualify for four individual events in one Olympiad, when she qualified for a total of five events, including the 400-meter medley relay. That year, at the Olympic Games in Barcelona, Spain, she won four Olympic medals: gold in the 200-meter butterfly, gold in the 200-meter medley relay, silver in the 200-meter individual medley, and bronze in the 400-meter individual medley. While still competing, Summer began working in television, becoming a staple presence as a commentator, host, analyst, and on-site reporter for Olympic coverage on NBC, CBS Sports, and Yahoo Sports. She went on to spend 8 years co-hosting NBA Inside Stuff with Ahmad Rashad and became a sideline reporter for the WNBA, as well as a feature correspondent for NBA on NBC. Her television career took off as she expanded her range to include regular appearances on MTV, ESPN, Fox Sports, and the Food Network. She became the first ever woman to host a Nickelodeon game show. It was called Figure It Out, and Nickelodeon named her their commissioner for the Nick Gas Channel. Fun fact, she also appeared in the movie Jerry Maguire, playing herself. She's now married to former World Cup ski racer Eric Schlope, with whom she has two children. Throughout her career, Summer has delivered a masterclass on elite performance, and importantly, on the longevity of elite performance. She takes us into the emotional moments before, during, and after her gold medal performance, and digs into how her family helped her navigate the ups and downs of sport. She's honest and open about the role that exercise plays in her life as she ages, as well as in setting an example for her kids. We get to cover a lot of ground with this remarkable human being today, and I hope you enjoy this conversation as much as I did. Well, I am thrilled to introduce somebody who was a huge role model for me as a swimmer growing up in the 90s, and She is not only a celebrated Olympian and television personality, but she is also a leader who remains at the forefront of really upholding the human part of human performance. So please join me in welcoming Olympic gold medalist, world champion, multi-time NC2A champion, and television host, reporter, analyst, correspondent, product developer, Summer Sanders.
It is so good to
Welcome
be with you.
Welcome, Summer.
I am so impressed with that intro. I mean, that's not my life. Did I really do those things? And my kids would say, and alarm clock, and on time, like, you know, policeman. Yeah. Thank you. It's good to
love
be with
it.
You.
I love it. Oh, thank you for being here. Yeah. And for those listening, it's fair to say that most of the people listening here are not Olympians or maybe not even aspiring Olympians. And they might be thinking, okay, you know, what am I going to learn from somebody who has just this wildly impressive career that doesn't relate to me at all? And I just want to say to those folks that one of the things I think people forget or don't understand is that the challenges that athletes face in sport are really and truly universal human challenges. These are people, they're human beings, and they're really striving to explore their own personal and human potential. And in a way, we are all doing that in our lives, regardless of whether you happen to play a sport, be an athlete, or, you know, aspire to the Olympics. So I'm just really excited to talk to you today and dig into how you think about performance, how you think about exploring potential, because I think that there's so much that we can all learn from you and learn from your experience. So again, thank you for being here today.
Yeah, like, look what I have, you guys. Welcome kit for U.S. Masters swimming. Anytime I talk to somebody who say that they were a swimmer and, oh, but I was never at your level, I really, truly, honestly say this, and I mean it, like, we're all the same level at some point in time, you know?
Yeah.
I'm going to get out there and I'm going to start swimming, but I can't do flip turns anymore because I had an inner ear infection or something. And so I get totally, like, my brain scrambles when I do flip turns. So I'm going to be out there doing open turns. And for anybody who doesn't know swimming, that means I'm not going to flip at the end. I'm literally going to touch the wall when I'm doing freestyle and then push off again. So yeah, you morph and you relearn your why, and your why kind of changes as you cruise along in your life. And I'm 51 now. And, you know, I say to people, swimming is my soul, but running is my heart. And my 6 miles that I used to do back then is now 4. And frankly, when I turn 60, it'll probably turn to 3 or 2 and might turn to walking every now and then. I've become very forgiving of myself. And also I've appreciated it a lot more.
I love that. I love that. Yeah. And I think another thing that people often forget is even the highest, most accomplished athletes like yourself all started from no experience. You had to start from zero to get to where you were. So you have this amazing experience that took you through almost all possible levels of the sport as you worked through to strive toward your Olympic gold.
Yeah.
Speaking of, let me just take a moment and dig into your background a little bit. And honestly, we could speak for hours about Summer's Palmares here. It defies belief, but at 15, you finished 3rd at the Olympic trials in the 200 IM, which, by the way, for other folks listening, Summer's events were the butterfly events and the individual medley events, which I will fight anybody on this. Those are two of the hardest disciplines in all of the sport. I know that distance swimmers will probably disagree with me, but
no, I don't think they will.
I will hold.
I think everyone will say that 400 IM is the toughest event. I think people have anxiety before they do the 400 IM for sure. And I think some people would say 200 backstroke and 200 freestyle are two of the toughest events. And the way I describe that to people is, I think most people would say the 800 and 400 are two of the hardest events in track, right? Because they're not really, you can't really lag. You kind of have to sprint the whole way. So that's what makes it slightly difficult, more difficult.
Exactly.
And I think those are the 200s in swimming. So go ahead, proceed.
Thank you so much for validating that, my assertion here. Yeah, absolutely. This is an incredibly difficult event. And at 15, you finished 3rd at the Olympic trials. And that just means that you missed making the Olympic team at 15 by one place, which is just astonishing. And I think a lot of people would look at that and say, oh, well, you know, what an overnight phenom, like, you just had it from the start. But another thing about swimming that's important to remember is that by 15, you've put in a lot of work and a lot of time. You know, that result was probably the tip of the iceberg for what you had put into the sport at that point.
Yes. And I had a lot of lows. So yeah, for people let me say a couple things about your question there. Number one, I got third by 27 one-hundredths of a second. So I sort of joke about it, but it was basically like just Lee press on nails on one hand and just like a tiny bit touching the wall, like just a millisecond before I did. A lot of people looked at that moment in my life at 15 as a big failure. I appreciate failures. But it wasn't. I was not expecting to even make the finals in that event. So the fact that I was standing up there with seven other amazing swimmers and that I was included in that mix was like mind-blowing for me. So it wasn't a failure. It was a huge stepping off point and growth point for me and certainly lit my fire for the next 4 years. So I think that inspired me to work as hard as I did. I started swimming when I was 4 and I started on year-round swimming when I was 7. So by the time I was 15, I was 8 years into it. And anybody who knows swimming knows that we overtrain more than any other sport. So my yes. longest race was 4 minutes and a half, like 4.5 minutes, 4 minutes and change. And, you know, our workouts were 2.5 hours twice a day. So none of it really makes sense. They've gotten smarter with their training now. But back then it was like I was at the tail end of that idea of the more time you put into the pool and the harder your workouts are, the faster you're going to be at the end of the season. And that's shifted quite a bit. So yeah, so going back to just missing the Olympic team was probably one of the biggest points in my life and one of the moments I cherish in my journey to winning Olympic gold. I wouldn't have written the script any differently.
Yeah, I love that point that a lot of people view that as a failure. So, you know, even the way that we're describing it, like you just missed the Olympic team. I mean, the other way of putting that is like you came this close to making the Olympic team at 15, which is unbelievable. But to your point, it's so easy to look at that as like, oh, it was you missed out versus holy smokes, look how far you got in such a relatively short time.
You know, there's a new term floating around and it's called intelligent failure in sport. And I do think that that's something that parents and kids can hold on to. So, right, when we get older and we're doing our fun races, you know, whether it's half marathon, 5K, marathon, half Ironman, whatever you're into, there is really no failure. I mean, the trying and the training is part of the package and we get that as we're adults. But when you're younger and you have an adolescent brain, I think that the idea of intelligent failure in sport just makes I can't stand the word failure because I think it comes with such a negative idea of it. But for me, it's just such a normal part of evolution and growth as a human being. So the sooner and the quicker that we can look at a setback, so to speak, or a hiccup in your journey and view it as such an asset. I mean, it's like such a moment where you can choose, am I going to learn from this? Am I going to get better? Or am I going to get discouraged? And then is it going to kind of be in my fear backpack, right? Ooh, maybe I won't try as hard next time because I don't really want to fail. Or maybe I won't do that race anymore because now I just really don't like it. That moment for me was just such a huge moment in figuring out why I do what I do, even at 15, right? It's like, why am I in the pool that many hours every single day? Oh, it's because not only do I want to win, I want to make the Olympic team, but I want to win a medal. And then at some point, I really, really believed I could absolutely do it because I'd come this close to making the team.
And that's incredible, right? Because what we wouldn't all give for that level of clarity and conviction, and what a gift that moment must have been in that sense, right? Because you had this idea that you wanted to do this, but to have that confirmed so powerfully must have been unbelievable.
Yeah. And at the time, I had no clue. I was just, a sophomore in high school, like cruising along. But there was no question in my mind very soon afterwards that probably, and this is going to sound awful, but I think people can understand, the only reason why I was really bummed about not making that Olympic team is I really wanted all the swag. I wanted all those rings on my sweatshirt. Everybody was getting this really cool stuff, like duffel bag after duffel bag of really cool swag. And that's why I wanted it, right? That's not a reason to make an Olympic team. And frankly, that wasn't going to be a motivation or inspiration to do something at the Olympic Games. So I knew that in my head. I don't know how I had that wherewithal to understand that that just wasn't enough to be really, really devastated by not making the Olympic team. Instead, it was a driver. And Amber, I had so much to look forward to in my future.
Yes.
The Olympics were part of my process, but as you had mentioned in my intro, I had NCAA titles that I won. And for me, my next phase was not supposed to be the Olympic Games. It was supposed to be a college scholarship and to be able to compete for a college, for a university with my 23 other badass women and stand up there at NCAA championships and swim with your whole heart and a little bit more. And I knew I wanted to do that. So that was the next stage. And that was the next goal that I had. And so I saw the whole picture somehow at such a young age.
That's amazing. That's amazing. And I really, there's so much of this that I want to dig deeper into. So we will come back to a lot of the thoughts that you just mentioned. But I do want to get through at least cover the highlights or summary of your total career. So yeah, that lit a fire for you. And the very next year, you were in your very first international meet, which was the Pan Pacific Championships, and you won a silver medal again in the 200 IM. And this was just behind Lin Li of China, who you came back a couple years later at the Pan Pacific Championships and beat her in the 400 meter individual medley, winning gold. And then you also won gold in the 200 meter butterfly, again, some of the hardest events in the sport. And yeah. And then that same year, speaking of college scholarship, you enrolled at Stanford, and in your tenure at Stanford, you won eight NC2A National Championships titles. You won back-to-back NC2A Swimmer of the Year titles. You helped the team win the 1992 NC2A National Championships. And you were the recipient of the Honda Sports Award for Swimming and Diving, which recognized you as the outstanding college female swimmer of the year in both 1991 and 1992. Amazing. Amazing.
Yeah, it was a fun couple of years. Yeah.
And we're just getting going here because, again, in 1991, you went to World Championships in Perth, Australia, where you won a World Championship title in the 200-meter butterfly. You won a silver in the 200-meter individual medley and a bronze in the 400-meter individual medley. Again, so tough, just astonishing. And, of course, that rolled into the 1992 Olympic trials, where you became the first woman since Hall of Famer Shirley Babashoff to qualify for four individual events in one Olympiad. So not only were you carrying this drive into qualifying, but qualifying in a record-setting way. And then at the Olympic Games in 92 in Barcelona, you won four Olympic medals, gold in the 200-meter butterfly, gold in the 400-meter medley relay, silver in the 200-meter individual medley, and bronze in the 400-meter individual medley. So I want to pause for a second because we talked about at 15, that framing of this huge failure of not having made the team. And in one of your interviews that I saw with Mel Stewart, you had this really powerful story about your perspective on being at the Olympics and being interviewed about your bronze and your silver, which, by the way, were American records. Am I right?
Both of them.
And I want to hear your perspective. So tell me about how you were being interviewed at that time, what that was like for you. And I want to dig into that a little bit because that ties in with this idea of framing a failure, which may or may not have been a failure.
Yeah, I think, you know, so going into these next Olympic Games, which are in 2024 in Paris, I do think it would be really nice for the public to sort of understand the perspective. Back in 1992, I, as you said, was going to be swimming in five events, right? A relay and four individual events. And America is so wonderful. And I love being from this country and I love this country so much. But we really do at times get our perspective a little wacky in what's possible. So because I was swimming in five events, they thought, okay, she has a chance to win five gold medals. Well, I mean, if I was to swim lights out and the best ever, and also all of my competitors were to have the worst day ever, then maybe. So it was talked about so much. My name was obviously perfect for the Summer Games. And so when I got up there for my first event and I, you know, was really in there and very close, and I touched the wall and got a bronze and broke my hero's American record, I felt like the question was just sort of slightly lazy, right? To put it just really bluntly. There could have been other ways to say it. Everyone was talking about you winning a gold, you win a bronze, tell me what you're feeling, something like that. But it really was, you just won a bronze, you must be so disappointed. And oh, I did want to say to the interviewer, oh, do you want a chance to ask that again? Like, I there was empathy that I felt for him because he was a former swimmer. And I just felt like, oh, he probably didn't know what else to ask. Or maybe they were saying it in his IFB. So all these people have these earpieces and their producer is talking to them in their ear. They very well could have just said, hey, ask her if she's disappointed. So maybe that's what he did. So I sort of felt empathy, sympathy for him being in that position and probably being quite nervous. But I do look back on it. And if I was, you know, an adult and had like the wherewithal and the boldness and the brave feeling that I have now, I probably would have said to him, I think that's a very lazy question. No, I'm thrilled. But I did. I did in a way. I was like, no, I'm so excited. I just broke my hero's American record. And I found myself in that position of standing up for each medal that I won. And by the time the silver rolled around and I was again asked, you must be so disappointed, I think I was disappointed at that time in the way I was being asked it and the way my medals were being sort of, I felt, portrayed back to people. So going back to the beginning of this answer, I would say to the viewers in watching these Olympic Games to remember that any, first of all, being at the Olympics is so extraordinarily difficult now more than ever to make this U.S. Olympic team, specifically in swimming and track and field, is extraordinary. And now to win any medal, any color, I'm telling you, I bring my medals around everywhere and people feel the weight of them. The weight of a bronze medal is exactly the same as the weight of a silver medal, which is exactly the same as the weight of a gold medal. They are all very heavy. It's the first thing people say when they hold my medals. Oh my God, these are so heavy. And I always respond with, shouldn't they be? Because the journey is incredible. It's worth the wait. Yeah. So that's the story of my medals. Yeah.
I love it. And one of the things that you said in your interview was that the first emotion that you had about winning your gold after that constant, that you're fighting a tsunami of interview questions asking you about disappointment, disappointment, disappointment. I mean, and especially at that age, it's only understandable that that would start to shape how you were feeling, and that by the time you actually won your gold, your very first emotion was relief that you wouldn't necessarily be disappointing people again.
And
one
know,
of the things talk about that a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah. No. And honestly, Amber, I'm glad you brought that up because it was just recently when I was hanging out with some other Olympians and I forget what sport and I actually forget who it was, but they felt the exact same way. They felt relief. Mm. So I don't want, like, obviously I want people to see a holistic athlete there when they're watching the games. And to remember that they are individuals and they're human beings. But part of the reason why these athletes are in this situation is because they can handle it, right? Mm-hmm. It is pressure beyond pressure. And what's interesting is I remember when Michaela Schifrin in the Beijing Olympics, remember when everyone was like, why is NBC so focused on her and there shouldn't be all this pressure on her and all of this? But I also was like, wait a second. 2 weeks previous to that, or maybe not even 2 weeks, maybe around 2 weeks, the camera was straight in the helmet into the eyes of Josh Allen from the Buffalo Bills, who is the quarterback, who is also 26 years old. And he didn't get a shot to come back on the field to take his team and do anything with the overtime. The Chiefs won and he was devastated and he was pissed off and he's 26. And now all of a sudden we go to the Olympic Games and we see Michaela Schifrin, who's also 26, not achieving what she wanted to achieve in that one moment. But both of these athletes are so incredibly equal. Part of the reason why they are where they are, of course, is natural ability and skill and hard work. But on the mental side, it's because they thrive in pressure and they can handle the pressure. So we need to honor that and we need to respect them in that that's part of the reason why they're so amazing. But I do think in looking at the holistic athlete, it is so incredibly important to remember that, again, back to the medals, being there is extraordinary. You can feel bad for them, but also know that they are very strong and they are very capable and they thrive in these pressure situations. So when I finally won my gold medal and I was 19 years old, the first thing I felt was, oh, thank God. Thank God I'm walking away from these Olympic Games with a gold. That was the goal all along. That's what I wanted to do. But I wasn't 26. I was 19 and it was my first Olympics. And I know so much more now. And I think I knew so much more 4 years later. I just didn't get a chance. I didn't put myself in a position to make the Olympic team and do it all over again. But I realize now I'm not alone in that initial feeling of crossing the finish line, touching the wall, and realizing you just won gold. I think I wanted that old school, oh my God, I just surprised myself and won a gold medal. This is crazy. This is amazing. It's a lot different when you're expected to win.
Yeah, it robs you of that opportunity to just revel in the joy of the culmination of all of your efforts. Because, yeah. I mean, it sets up. And to your point, you're prepared for that pressure, but the expectations of the public and the reporters who are interviewing you to take a really, I'll say, you know, an uninformed lens on it, right? Because an American record and a bronze medal are far from failures. Those are, I mean, I don't even, it just boggles my mind that somebody could look at that as a failure. Because again, we're talking about the Olympic Games here, folks. It's not just the USA, right? Every single country is sending athletes who have come up through the ranks, who are the world's best, and they are coming with their A game and they are prepared and they're in their peak form and they have done everything that our athletes have done. And to your point, it's like, yeah, if all of your competitors had their worst day ever, it might be a cakewalk. But that's the whole point of the Olympic Games, is that it's not a cakewalk.
Well, and remember, times were so different back then. So yeah, people got caught up in the narrative and I don't blame them. I do the same thing. If I don't know a sport and somebody's telling me this person has a chance to do this, I'm going to hop on that train, mostly because I want to wish the best for them. I want them to far exceed their expectations. Right. Can you imagine now? So going back to these two athletes, so Josh Allen, by the way, if you don't know, I'm a Buffalo Bills fan, huge Joshie J. He's my guy. I've always believed in him as a quarterback. And I love Mikayla Shiffrin. She went to the same high school that my husband did and my son is at right now. So I believe in them wholeheartedly. So nowadays, these young athletes, and back then I didn't even have cell phones. The internet wasn't really invented. I mean, I think the World Wide Web was like just a thing. Now they have social media. They have all of these other like inputs of possible negativity or distraction or whatever. That's why mental health is so important and such an important two words that we need to take seriously to support these young brains. You know, you still have an adolescent brain until you're 25. So that's a ton of our Olympic team right there is still an adolescent brain and trying to remind themselves of who they are, why they do it, who really loves them, who I should really care about. Again, why I do it when they're standing up on the blocks. Simplify the moment when it's so big. And that's difficult to do. And it's more difficult now for sure than it was in 1992.
Yeah, that actually is a great segue into a topic that I wanted to bring up today, which is this idea of mental health in sport. And I'm going to bring up another quote from another interview you did. You said, you were speaking to the friends of people who may have just finished an Olympic competition. And you said, continue to invite Olympians to do normal things. Tell them, don't bring your medal, just come hang out, and to remind them of who they are and why they matter, and that it has nothing to do with their performance in the Olympic Games. What keeps their mental health in check comes down to who cares about them. Mm-hmm. So, and you mentioned the Olympic blues. So can you talk to us about what the Olympic blues are and how that connects to this advice that you were imparting?
I'm going to tell you what my mindset was before my Olympic gold medal moment. I was mentally, physically drained. I honestly didn't even know if I was going to be able to finish my 200 butterfly. So I knew I had to dig deep and I had to do something different. And Barcelona was an outdoor venue, but we had this like inner walkway, a hallway on the inside. And I went for a little walk. We had security back then, but I don't know where they were. So I was just walking around this hallway and I found a bathroom all by myself. And so I went in and there was a mirror and I had a moment with myself and I asked myself, why do you swim? And the answer was very clear, because I love it. Who do you swim for? And again, the answer was very simple. I swim for myself. That might sound selfish to some people, but it's also incredibly uncomplicated. And it just takes weight off of your shoulders when you're just doing it for yourself. And then finally, who loves you? And the people who loved me were there. My mom, my dad, my aunt, my grandparents weren't there, but I knew they loved me no matter what. My best girlfriend was in the stands, some other of my college friends. I knew that they loved me no matter what I did out there. And so I say this to young athletes and I say this to established athletes. When you have created that foundation that's just unbreakable, then you can stand out there in the world's toughest, most pressure cooker stage, and you've taken away all the chaos. And so that's what I did. So I stood on the blocks. I looked at a sign on the right-hand side, which said Barcelona 1992 with the Olympic rings. I said to myself, this is your last time in this pool at this moment. I dove in and swam the most imperfect race. I've never swum a 200 butterfly like that. I think I gave my parents a heart attack. And I willed myself and like went back to the basics at the end of just get your arms over the water, get your arms over the water. And somehow, some way, I touched the wall first. So yes, in that moment, I do think it's incredibly important to always remember who you are, why you do it, and who loves you. And that goes back to, and I think I wrote that on Instagram after Michaela, or maybe it was Simone Biles, of just these intense moments, but also the incredible need to be a normal, real person and know your worth as a human being, not just an Olympic athlete at that stage. I always say to people, the greatest gift that my parents gave me was just this sense of, yeah, your swimming matters, but it doesn't dictate what our family does. So if I went to a swim meet and I didn't swim well, we went to the pizza party with the team, no matter what. We didn't cut out, not go because, oh, Summer's in a pissed off mood. She doesn't want to be around, you know, her swim friends. No, you go to the pizza party anyway. So either way, we went to the pizza party and that always just gave me this sense of, oh, no one really cares, right? I'm just the same person, whether I lose or in the moment, like celebrate competitiveness. I say that to parents also. Yeah. If your kid is pissed off after a race and they want to have a tantrum and they want to cry, just tell them, you know what? That's valid, but you need to go over there and do it. And then you need to come back and be a good teammate. But go ahead and be pissed for a second. I'm going to validate those feelings. Just don't do it right here. And then bring yourself back in. So yeah, all of that is the whole package of, you know, containing the amazing competitive value, but also self-worth.
There's two really powerful things here that I want to dig into. One is, I think people at all levels, whether you are a competitive athlete, whether you're an elite athlete, whether you're somebody who's, you know, getting on a bike or getting in a pool just to exercise or for fun or as an escape, it's so easy and tempting to start to tie our self-identity and self-worth with, did we nail that workout? Did I get a good result in that race? And instead of separating what we're doing, the behavior, the action, the result from who we are, we start to blur those lines and we don't take ourselves to the pizza party.
Yeah. You know, you're missing out on the fun.
That's such a beautiful story. And it's, you're missing out. Yeah.
And by the way,
you're missing out on the whole point of being there.
You got into this sport because it was fun. That was your first tie to it. You didn't know you were going to be good at whatever sport it was. You got into it because you were fun. I also have a totally different perspective on the whole participation medal I always say to parents, I have a high school senior and a high school sophomore, and I do not think participation medals are a problem in our country, because beware, you take participation medals out of the equation and all of a sudden you're crossing the New York City Marathon finish line and they're just giving you a high five and you don't get a medal. And meanwhile, we adults are very aware that we have just crossed the finish line in 6,526th place, nowhere near a podium finish, but we will wear that medal home on the airplane ride. Why? Because we're proud of it. So be proud of your season or your moment. Even if you finished last, you're still going to get a medal. That's the case at an adult level. And you do it because it's fun and because the training is powerful. And similarly, when your kid is five, and you think that they don't care about soccer because they're doing cartwheels or picking dandelions, the process is fun. And if they've shown up for practice and they've done some of the work, let them have a participation medal. It's more, I always feel like, don't drive your kids' homework to school when they've forgotten it and you know that they haven't really been present in their schoolwork. Like, maybe that's the participation medal that you should cut off so that they feel a little bit of the consequence. But that's my two cents.
Well, and I think we joke about the participation medal, but it's not just about participation. I think that the point that it really drives home is the importance and accomplishment in showing up, because that is so important and so hard to do sometimes, especially for younger kids. But for all of us sometimes, it's sometimes the hardest thing is just to get out of bed and show up. And if you can not only show up to a marathon, but you can finish the dang thing, then I say, yeah, wear that thing with pride. I mean, I'm speaking as somebody who's like really not a runner because my body doesn't work that way. And I have the utmost respect for those who do. But yeah, to me, if I ever finish a marathon, heck yeah, I am getting that participation medal and I am taking it with me, because it's so much more than participation. It's so much more than that. And I love that you brought this up because I think it's so important.
Yes, it's the process. Yeah. It's the journey. I remember thinking to myself, because I've run six marathons and I've loved all of them. My first one was 99 New York.
That's amazing.
And then I kind of run them for my decades. So I'm due for one because I'm 51 and I haven't run one in my 50s. But there was a point in time where I really felt like, oh, people probably see, you know, marathon runners or maybe triathlon, because they take so much training and so much time. And by the way, we're normal adults, so we also have jobs. And then we're trying to be parents and, you know, all this stuff. That they must look at us and think, oh, we're quite selfish with our time to be taking this time to do it. And there were two things that I noticed. Number one, my son and my daughter really did learn about sweat from me. Because when I was training for the Chicago Marathon before my 40th birthday, I would come home from my runs and they'd be watching something on a Saturday morning or a Sunday morning or something. And I would come in and my son would go, what is that all over your face, Mom? And he would touch it and he's like, oh my God. And I was like, okay, that's sweat. This is good. My heart is working and it's pumping and all my blood is flowing. And so my temperature is up and I'm sweating and it's my body's way of regulating my temperature and all of this. It's really good for your system. So later that week, he would, you know, was out there on his skateboard or his Razor scooter or something. And he had his helmet on and he takes his helmet off and he's like, Mom, look, I've sweat underneath here. I'm working my heart. And I was like, yes, he learned that from his mama. Right. And then in running the races, I like to chat with people when I'm running. And I distinctly, I pick out the people who are running for others, running for a wife that was lost to cancer, running for Alzheimer's, running for different things, running for purpose. And I thought to myself, oh my gosh, those people are the opposite of selfish. They are selfless. They are out here putting their body into the pain cave to draw awareness to something or someone else. And that was part of the beauty of that community. And that's another reason why I realized, oh, it's so much more. It's so much more.
If you appreciate what we're doing and want to support the show, you can support us directly through Patreon and Ko-Fi. Both Ko-Fi and Patreon enable you to help us cover production costs through memberships with perks, like access to bonus episodes, merch, and more. We encourage you to check out our page on Ko-Fi, as they don't take a fee. You can find it at ko-fi.com/beagoodwheel. That's ko-fi.com/beagoodwheel. Unlike Ko-Fi, Patreon takes an 8% fee. That said, if you're already supporting other creators on Patreon, you can support us there too. Find us on Patreon at patreon.com/beagoodwheel. That's patreon.com/beagoodwheel. For even more ideas on how you can support the show, check out beagoodwheel.com/support. That's beagoodwheel.com/support. If the idea of being a good wheel resonates with you, check out the Be a Good Wheel community at beagoodwheel.com/community. The community is a virtual, membership-based organization of like-minded folks keen to continue exploring what it means to be a good wheel beyond the podcast. Connect with other folks on topics that go way beyond the bike, toward meaningful application and fellowship across industries and aspirations. Fuel your curiosity and inspiration by joining today. Learn more and join us at beagoodwheel.com/. I think this brings up two really interesting points that are related. One is this idea that training, engaging in a sport, whether competitive or for health, is a selfish endeavor that takes you away from your family. Because I know that a lot of folks who are parents who have full-time jobs really struggle with that. And then related to that is this idea, which you illustrated beautifully in this story with your son, of leading through example as a role model. So I want to dig into those two topics. So let's tackle the first one about feeling selfish, because you mentioned prior to your gold medal swim, you were getting yourself, you were getting rid of that chaos and really paring down to the essential, and the essential being that you swim for yourself. Mm-hmm. And I've spoken with a lot of women, especially women, but men too, a lot of women who really struggle with taking time away from family, away from their job, to train, to engage in exercise, or to compete, because it feels so selfish. What would you say to somebody who feels, who struggles with that, who feels selfish when they're taking time to do these things?
I would say that I validate everything that they're feeling. And it just means they love their family so much. But then I would have them step back for a second and recognize the true time that they're away from their family training for something. And then I would want them to really decide what kind of parenting and what you would actually be doing parenting-wise in those 2 hours, 1 hour, 45 minutes, whatever it is that you're giving yourself this gift. And it's really probably not a lot. Maybe you're making snacks or overseeing their homework. And again, those are things that you want to try to encourage your kids to do on their own, or engage your husband or your partner in assisting, because all of it's positive. And then, most importantly, if you are training for something and you've made that conscious decision, you will be a better parent because you've taken this time for yourself. I don't even know if there's studies, but I'm telling you, I am a doctor of this, and I have done my own study. You will be a better parent. You will be happier. You will be more present. You will be more engaged. And there is no better way to teach your children, as your second point is alluding to, than by example. It is one thing to sit there in your office chair doing your homework in front of your computer, telling your kids, hey, you guys need to get outside and you need to go do something outside and you need to get rid of energy. And while you're sipping on your coffee, you know, saying you need to be drinking water and you should be eating fruits and snacks and whatever. No, if you do it, you don't even have to say anything. They see you and they're in awe of you and they want to emulate you. These are things that they will strive to be more like. And that is a value that you can't even put a price tag on. So you are being a good parent by taking this time for yourself. So rework the words in your brain. I validate that you're going to feel guilty or whatever, whatever, but your kids are not missing you that much. Newsflash, and they're going to be okay. And they're going to have to start making their own decisions. You're leading by example and giving them the gift of the better decision to make.
Oh, I love that so much. And that concept of leading by example, I mean, it absolutely applies to kids. My husband and I have a 2-year-old now, and it does not matter what we tell her. She does what we do straight. Yep. I mean, it's just, that's just how it is. But it's also something that really translates into leadership in the adult world as well, leading by example as an adult. And one of your interviews, you talked about your relationship with your mom, and you went out of your way to clarify that she was always very truthful with you in her feedback. So positive, of course, proud of you, of course, but always very truthful in that she wasn't just going to be inauthentically positive regardless of what was going on. Mm-hmm. And I'm really curious about what that did for you. So dig into that a little bit more, this idea of authentic feedback.
Well, she was very creative. So let's just take it when I was really young. And she would have been a great athlete. She really would have. And my aunt as well. They were born and raised in Nebraska. Go Big Red were the first three words she wanted all of her kids, grandkids to learn. So they loved sport and they knew sport very well. She just didn't have a chance. There was no opportunity for her. So she saw me and my talent and my natural gift for this sport. And many times she bit her tongue. So when I would come home and I'd be like, oh, I'm just tired. I don't think I feel good. I don't want to go to practice. She would never tell me, you have to go to practice. I pay blah, 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 blah every single month. I work bingo for this team. I put in so many hours. You are going to practice. Her response was, okay, well, where are you feeling sick? All right. And do you think you're going to feel guilty if you don't go to practice? Like, do you think in an hour you're going to think to yourself, oh, I should have gone to practice? So she would ask me these questions. And in the end, I knew what she was doing. I would be like, oh, okay, I'm going to go to practice. But she never pointed her finger. She never talked about the money she was spending on this sport. She never, like, there was none of this, like, negative or other reasons why she would want me to do this, because that's not why she wanted me to do it. She wanted me to go to practice because she saw how much talent that I had. And she also knew it's very addictive. If you don't go to practice once, it's going to be easier to not go to practice the second time and a third time and blah, blah, blah. So she got me down that path. She was very honest. She did not coddle. She did stand up for me. I'm talking about her as if it's past tense. She's still here. It's just in my swimming career, this is the way she behaved.
Yeah.
I was always on time. I'm still that way. I'm kind of crazy with it. But there was one time in particular when my coach, who was new, his name was Mike Hastings, and I was 10. And he made it clear, do not be late for practice. It is disrespectful. It will not end up well for you. I mean, safe sport is a little different now, but he would make us do things if we were late, like stand on the side of the pool deck in a streamlined position on your tippy toes for 5 minutes. And if you messed up, you had to start over again. So I had my bags packed, ready to go. My parents divorced when I was 7. So my mom was technically a single parent for 6 months out of the year. And she's like working in Sacramento, coming back to Roseville to get me, then to take me back to Fair Oaks. So anybody from Northern California in that area knows the distance, but it's like 45, 50 minutes each way. My bags were packed. She was late, traffic, whatever. She's also a working mom. So maybe it was her employer. We get to practice and I'm late and I'm running in there. And coach stops me and he starts yelling at me. And I don't work well when people yell at me when I was little. Now I kind of laugh, but yelling at me. And so I cry and I'm in the locker room and my mom walked straight up to him and said, don't you yell at her for being late. She is always ready to go. Her bags were packed. I was late. If you want to yell at someone, you yell at me. And that's also a badass moment, right? I mean, yeah. My mom stood up to the coach and it was truthful and it was real. And he never yelled at me again. That's not coddling. That's showing me I can be a badass woman and I can speak my mind and really speak it when I know it's the truth. And going back to your kids, you know, feed off of you. And that's kind of some of the best parenting. Can I cuss on this podcast?
Yes, you can.
Okay. I have a trucker mouth. I have the worst mouth in the whole world. And my daughter, when she was 4, something fell or she did messed up or something. We were in the laundry room and she was like, shit. And I looked at her and I was like, oh my God, what did you say? And she goes, shit. And I said, why did you say that? And she's like, I was really frustrated because this dropped. And I said, that is an accurate use of that word. So I didn't get mad at her. I simply said, I just need you to know in these four walls, that's okay. But if you go to school and you use that word, you are going to get in trouble. You cannot really use it outside of this house. But, you know, in those moments, you have a choice. I know she got it from me. I taught her that word 110%. So I couldn't get mad at her. Really accurate use of the word. So nice job there.
Yeah.
But yeah, so fun.
And no ill intent, right?
No, no.
Like just honest.
Authentic and raw.
Just...
Yeah, totally.
I love that. Well, I think this is an important component of performance for one, and also leadership on the other hand, is providing feedback and being authentic about providing feedback. Because sometimes it's not easy to deliver, you know, critical feedback if it's not really positive, or receive critical feedback. Yeah. Was that something that played a role in your success either as an athlete or later in television? And I will get into more of your television career in a little bit, but let's focus on this question for a moment. Just this idea of authentic feedback. How has that played a role for you, and what have you learned about it?
Well, I think it's vital. Authentic feedback is vital if you want to be outstanding. And I think it's totally fine if you want to be very good at something. But if you want to be, and I remind myself of this when I want to feel better in my 50s, that I was the best in the world at something. And if you want to be the best in the world, you have to be able to accept authentic feedback. I think it's one of the most valuable things to be able to hear. Oftentimes people won't give it to you unless you ask for it. So then part of, you know, the courage is to ask. And, you know, going back to my mom, those were things I could ask my mom. I remember asking her all the time, God, do you think I'm a little overweight? I knew I was overweight. I mean, I knew it could be leaner. So I would ask my mom, do you think I could be leaner? Do you think I look okay? And she's like, I think you could be leaner. It's not mean of her to say that to me. Right? It's what I do with it. And if I want to be the best, I have to be able to take that.
Yeah. It's not an aesthetic issue. It's an integral component of performance at that point, because you're already competing at the absolute peak of the sport. So this isn't a, you know, do I look good in these jeans question. This is a, you know, I need real feedback from somebody who's not going to be worried about hurting my feelings, who understands that this isn't a, you know, a vanity question, that this is a very real performance related question that I'm asking from somebody who knows me really well. Like,
well, and also it is maybe a fit in my jeans. I mean, it is a, do I feel good about myself? Right. I mean, sometimes you know the answer, and you choose the person you trust the most to ask the most uncomfortable question. And you know, those aren't the best. I mean, if you're sitting there and you have your best girlfriend and you go shopping with her, and your best girlfriend doesn't tell you, those don't look the best on you, let's try on something else. Like, what in the world? What's going on? I'm that way with my daughter. My daughter has a totally different body type than me. And I had horrible experiences shopping because I had really long legs. Everything was high water on me. Nothing fit me. And my daughter is a little bit different. She has she is powerful. She has power in her lower body. I will not let her leave a shopping experience without finding something that she lights up when she puts on, that makes her feel so good. And that is not the case with all of her friends. And she says, it's one of the greatest compliments I've gotten from my daughter is, I tell my friends all the time, if you want to feel good about yourself, come shopping with my mom. She'll make you feel good about yourself. I'm not going to sugarcoat, like, some things don't look good, but we're not leaving the shopping experience without finding your thing, because everyone's different and you're going to look good in something before we leave here.
And that gets to the core of it, right? Which is trust. Because if you're just blowing smoke and sprinkling compliments willy-nilly that are, you know, not true, not genuine, then they lose all meaning. And then when you do say, and sincerely, that looks great, it's not going to have the same power or meaning as when you know your daughter knows that she can really trust that. And it's
yes.
Every single time that you're delivering that feedback, you're either building or eroding that trust. And that's the cornerstone of any relationship, right?
Totally. That's the most important part of this entire equation. Assume that the person who's asking you already knows the answer and they're testing you. How honest is this person going to really be with me? Right? So yeah. Have the guts to have a true, and this is sport, right? If you get done with training and you know it was awful and you want to talk to your coach and you expect them to say, no, wasn't that bad? You did this well and you did that well. You need to be able to take, you know what? That was not your best day. It's not your best day. But I tell yes. you what, learn from not your best day, go home, think about it for a second, then flush it down the toilet and come back here and get better. But you have to be able
yes.
to hear not great things about yourself to be outstanding.
Right. Yeah. I mean, if you come back to your coach after every swim and every single swim, they're just like, great job. That was great. I mean, you're just going to stop going to them because what's the point? It's going to stop feeling good after a while, number one. And number two, you're not learning anything. So number one, you're eroding trust as that person in a position of authority. And number two, you are robbing that person of an opportunity to learn and grow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I had a point when I was 14, when my mom couldn't say the right thing to me. She would say, well, that wasn't your best race. And I'd be like, you're awful. You're not supportive. You're so mean. Or she would say, I thought that was a pretty good race. You don't know anything. That was horrible. How could you say that? She couldn't say anything right. And it was just a bad stage. You know, I don't know if you were a jerk, an asshole. I called myself an asshole when I was 14. I totally was. My mom thought she had completely lost like any relationship with me whatsoever. And then I found my way back when I was 15. But you're gonna get in trouble as a parent by saying the wrong thing. But if you can't say that wrong thing to your own kid, who's gonna say it? And maybe it is the coach. Maybe you want that to be the coach. And this is actually a really good thing. If we have any parents listening who have kids in sport, and I am speaking on behalf of my husband, who's a 3-time Olympian in alpine skiing, and me, an Olympic gold medalist in the sport of swimming, you have got to stay in your lane. A parent is a parent, and a coach is a coach. When you see that, you know, your kid is sad and not themselves, and then a parent can step in and say to the coach, hey, there's something going on here and we need to talk about it. I don't know if there's something going on at practice or the way you're delivering your message to her or something like that, but let's just take a look at her mental well-being here. Totally. That's a parent moment to step in and talk about the way he or she is coaching. But when you have these parents that think they know more than the coach, 99% of the time, Eric and I know more than the coach, but we're not the coaches. And I've never been a coach and I don't want to be the coach. I want to be the parent. So let the coach do that thing, right? Let the coach have his or her lane and be that support system on the sideline. So yeah, vital, vital. And I always have that. My mom stepped in that one time and said, don't you dare yell at her. And she didn't then come up to Mike and say, I think she should be swimming this. And I think you need to work on this with her. And I think she should be. No. And my dad on the other side walked up to my coach and said, hey, I'm going to take summer on vacation in January. You have these 2 weeks to choose from. Which week is better for you? And he said, my coach said, oh my God, she can't go on vacation. No. That's our hardest training session. No, she can't. And my dad said, I think you misunderstood me. I'm her parent. I'm taking her on vacation, but I'm giving you the choice of the week. And so he was like, this is ridiculous. I went on vacation and I had the best season of my life to the point that my coach Mike went up to my dad the next year and said, hey, when are you taking summer on vacation again? Because he knew it was so good. So like there was a parent moment that trumped the coach, right? But they never overstepped. And I think that that's really important for parents to remember. There are several ways to coach. They might be different than the way you do. If your kid asks an opinion on, you know, what do you think about my recovery, or how does my start look, or my turns, or in ski racing for my son, like, Dad, I'm having trouble with this. If he asks you, give your opinion. But if they don't, you know, stay in your lane and be the support system or the accountability checker or whatever it is that you are as the parent.
Yeah, I love that. Your parents really stepped in for you as a person. So they're there to parent you as the person and who you are. And your coach's job is there to develop the athlete. And those are the really clear roles that I love that. When are you taking a summer on vacation again? your dad knew you. He knew you as a person, and he understood that this was a holistic part of what was going to help you as a person and an athlete. I want to just quickly jump back to a joking comment that you made about being a jerk when you were 14, because I'm so excited to have you here, because I actually really want to personally thank you for something. When I was growing up as a swimmer, one of the things that I really looked up to you for was how you were this wicked, fierce competitor, but you were also so incredibly kind and just an obviously good person. And for some reason, as a young athlete, I really struggled with this because I feel it. I'm a competitive person. I have this really deep internal competitive drive, and I couldn't deny that part of myself. But at the same time, there's a lot of social pressure, especially at that time, for girls, especially around that age, to be likable. And being competitive and being likable didn't always seem to jive. And I struggled with that so much. And it wasn't until later in my swimming career that I was really able to like wrap my head around the concept and articulate what that was and reconcile that for myself. But one of the things that you did, again, leading by example, was you just did that. You just did. You just competed with every bone in your body, with no mercy, with pure ferocity, and you didn't feel like you had to be any different than who you were. Just a genuinely nice, good, kind person. And when I saw that in you as a young kid growing up, it made me feel like that was possible for me too, that I didn't have to conform to some personality type in order to be competitive, or that I didn't have to deny my competitive nature to be likable or be a nice person. And since you're here, I just want to say thank you for that, because
that is the sweetest. Wow. It's the best compliment. I really, really appreciate it. And I'm glad I could be that person for you. And you know, I think we continue to hold on to those people in our lives, because it doesn't get any easier as a woman when you get into, you know, a competitive business scenario. I do remind people that there's room at the top for several women. And if you can help pull them up the ladder, the space on top is amazing, and it's better with more women there. So, you know, because you've made it to the top doesn't mean there's not any space for more women at the top. Always be that person that's helping pull people up. I've always felt that way. I never felt like, and again, it just goes back to why I swam and who I swam for. I swam because I love it, and I swim for myself. And I'm not swimming to take other people down. That wasn't my competitive fire, right? I get it that some sports are inherently, like my daughter plays rugby and she has to compete and get physical with another team to beat them. We were lucky. We didn't have to do that. We stood in our lane and we had to choose to enter the pain cave and at times feel like we were going to die and not make it to the end of the lane and the finish. That was a choice that we made, but it didn't affect anybody else. So I never looked at my race and stood on the blocks and wished everyone else a horrible race so that I could win. I only just focused on how much I loved to win. I really loved that feeling and I wanted it. I also just didn't recognize that if I won, other people didn't. But that was the scenario. And so I would have empathy afterwards when I would see, for example, at the gnarly event called the Olympic Trials, when you have the extreme of both emotions, right? The person who makes the team and then the person who gets third. And I did have teammates who got third, and I fully recognized and felt a weight knowing that because I got second or first meant they didn't make the team. And, you know, I felt that. And there's nothing you can say to your competitor and who is also your teammate in that moment But to your point, I don't think that you have to be fierce and cutthroat to be great. I do think you can be kind and be incredibly competitive.
100%. And I think when later in my cycling career, I finally connected the dots on it, at least for myself. And it was this revelation that as hard as I can push myself in training, I can never push myself as hard as I can when I have a competitor next to me. So that competitor is actually the key to me being able to discover my own potential. I need her in order for me to find my best performance. Without her, I'm not going to have that extra drive, that extra motivation to dig as deep as I need to dig. So in that sense, she's my greatest ally in striving for excellence and exploring my own potential. And I am that for her too. So when I show up and I'm competitive, I'm helping her learn what she needs to learn, what she needs to know to go back and train and come back again a better athlete and get closer and closer to that greatness that she's striving for. And so, you know, going back to this idea of failure, all of those disappointing performances, I say that in air quotes, at the Olympic trials, for so many people, that might have lit the fire that it lit for you at 15. Mm-hmm. And it's not necessarily a zero-sum game, right? Because they learn from it, and it's going to affect them in a deep way that's meaningful, that may actually unlock the key to their calling or the next big accomplishment.
I have to mention something really quickly, because what you just said, showing up for your teammates, is a very real thing. Even on your worst day, and this is why showing up every single day and always showing up, unless you're, you know, giant fever and in the hospital or whatever, but you show up and you authentically show up, not just for yourself, but that's why competing for Stanford and winning that NCAA championship in 1992 was my greatest accomplishment. My Olympic moment, as I said, was like, phew. I love my Olympic medals. I love the whole 7 days of my competition and all the swimming that I did and the journey that I had and how imperfect and awesome and, you know, self-building it was. But my goodness, for 3 days competing with those bad ass to the core women to try to beat the University of Texas and win the national championship because we had lost it the year before by a very narrow margin. To actually pull that off was the most, together as a family, was the most exceptional moment of my athletic career. You can't put value on that experience. That's why, I mean, I love collegiate sport to its core. Like, the NCAA model is the building block for all Olympic sports. Please do not mess with it. Please do not take it away. Keep all of these sports funded and somehow give these athletes an opportunity to really, really be great. Because if that model isn't there, these moments are lost. And these moments build incredible human beings. It's more than just the sport. It's CEOs that are women. Mm-hmm. It's entrepreneurs that are women. It's politicians that are women, game changers that are women. We need that more and more and more. And if that model goes away, that's why that moment was so important to me. I hold on to it like as close as I can to my heart.
I love that. And just stepping back for a moment, bigger picture, given how incredibly wildly successful your athletic career was, that was a highlight, is it says so much. And it's interesting because swimming is generally viewed as being an individual sport. And yes, we have the relays, but it's easy to forget that there are these moments of team that are so powerful. And you actually had another quote in a different interview where you were talking about one of your greatest treasures is a photograph of your family and friends reacting to your gold at the Olympic Games. So again, mm-hmm. you won gold at the Olympics, and yet you're talking about, you know, this peak experience of the NCAA championships with your teammates. I just love that. But this quote was about this treasured photograph of your friends and family reacting to your gold. And you described it as being right up there with the medal itself. And the moment you saw you'd won, you just wanted to jump in the pool in the stands with them. Those are two experiences that you're talking about that were peak experiences in your athletic career. And they all involved other people. The peak experience for you wasn't just about your accomplishment. What was meaningful about it was your connection with other people. So it's not just an individual triumph.
Yeah, it's the journey includes a village. And as I told you, like how involved my parents were in me as a human being, not so much me as a swimmer, but I knew My mom didn't have to tell me that it was tough for her to pay for my swimming. I knew it. For months and months, I had a mattress on a floor. She couldn't afford the box spring to like lift my mattress off the floor. She was mortified by that. I loved it because I just dived straight into my bed and didn't have to dive up to get in. I thought it was really cool. But when I saw the truck delivering my box spring, you know, 6 months later, I was pretty stoked to have a box spring to lift my bed up off the floor. I knew that it was tough for her to pay for my swimming, but she never held that over my head. So the journey, I knew everyone was included in this journey. My brother, I knew my brother gave up time with his parents because we all went to my swim meet. You know, my brother swam, but then he decided to do other things quite early in his life. And he was still like going to summer swim meets. We were all a part of this. So I do. I wish I had it here. It's in a different part of my house, but I always say, thank goodness that photographer had the wherewithal to literally take his camera and do a full 180 and turn the other way from me touching the wall to get my parents and that moment and the joy and the collective triumph of a moment and how relieved they were for me because they knew the pressure that I was under. And they were a part of it. It wasn't in this weird parents living through me kind of thing at all. No. And I wanted to look up. This first thing I wanted to do was like, can you scoop me up and take me home? And can we just have dinner and watch a movie at home? I just wanted to be the normal summer that like existed, you know, 364 of the other days a year. So I just wanted to be very real with them. And it was great that somebody captured that moment and their emotions. It's just beautiful.
Oh, I love that. And I think you're so right. It's not just about, you know, they're not like living vicariously through you, but so many people join athletes on these journeys. It's the family, it's the friends who are sharing in your triumphs and your challenges and your setbacks, and they are cheering you on, but they're also a part of your growth and a part of that path. And I promised that we would get into your TV career here a little bit. And I'm going to dig into that, and relate it back to this topic, because I think it's really interesting, because you actually started working in television while you were still competing in 1992. And you got going as a commentator, host, and analyst for CBS and NBC. And you've went on to build spanning many, many decades at this point, as a commentator, host, analyst, on-site reporter. You've been on for CBS Sports, NBC, Yahoo Sports. You've done Olympic coverage for the Summer and the Winter Games. You've been a game show host. You were, 8 years you co-hosted NBA Inside Stuff with Ahmad Rashad. So you have borne witness to a lot of athletes' journeys, a lot of their peak experiences. And so it's not just speaking from your own experience, right? But you've seen this happen over and over and over again with countless athletes in these peak moments, and seeing the fans be a part of their journeys and celebrate in those moments, not vicariously, but with genuine sharing in the triumph.
Yeah.
Do you see that as a consistent theme across the different athletes that you've worked with and observed over the years?
I think more and more, I would say that my generation of athlete was pretty rad because we were raised by these people who, specifically the women, who didn't have Title IX, who didn't have the opportunity to pursue their greatness in sport. And then, frankly, didn't have that like direct opportunity for higher education without, having to pay for it. I always say to people, don't discard Title IX. First of all, Title IX is so much more than sport, which I hope people take a second and actually read what Title IX is. But before Title IX, 5% of law school and medical school were women. Now, 51 years later, over half of law school and medical school are women. We're just better as a society when we have women charging. You know, we know what women can do. Like, we're pretty extraordinary. But now they're in positions to show people, and people listen to women so much more now than they did. So I guess my point is like, I think what you're saying is I do think my generation, we saw everything. We were grateful for everything. We knew it was a lot of people working behind the scenes to allow us to fulfill our dreams. It wasn't easy to heat a pool in Northern California.
No.
I know people think that California is so warm and all that kind of stuff, but it's not in the wintertime and we have no indoor pools. these pools have to get heated. So, I mean, I was switching pools left and right to find a pool that was working. So many pools would break. And that took the entire city helping us out to find a pool. I think that there are some athletes that totally get it and see it. I feel that my responsibility now as an older athlete is to remind this next generation to continue to be grateful, to continue to fight for the space that we have and that they were so accustomed to, that it isn't guaranteed and it might not always be there for the next generation. And what a shame that would be, because I know that this generation right now can't imagine it. Can't imagine it.
Yeah.
Now you can make money in college and play your sport. Like, you can have a career at the same time. Back then, it wasn't that I turned pro. I gave up my eligibility. Do you see how that sounds different? I didn't turn and gain something. I gave up something. It was a very, very huge decision. It was my first big girl decision. I had to pull up my big girl pants. I was talking to my dad about it. He's like, I can't make this decision for you. I mean, I was 19 and I had to decide. And I love Stanford University. I love that school so much, and the people and my teammates and my friends and my community. But that was a really difficult decision to have to make. And now kids don't have to make that decision. So now imagine the next generation will only know that NIL existed. Oh, they won't be able to imagine a time when athletes weren't like able to make a living outside. So those are the narratives that we have to continue to tell so that they understand the progression and that you've got to hold tight to it and keep moving forward and pushing forward and being a voice.
Absolutely. And we touched on how involved you've been with athletes over the years. So through all of your work covering the Olympics, but you also had your own show in 2009, the Inside Out with Summer Sanders. And this was the very first original production by Universal Sports. And so you've really dug deep with a lot of these athletes. And one of your quotes, and this wasn't from your show, this was from a different interview that you did, but you were talking about Missy Franklin, and you said, she's cerebral, she's very smart, but she also gets it. Sometimes people who are extremely smart think too much when they're doing it. So you've interviewed and worked with a lot of athletes. Yeah. What does it mean to you for an athlete to get it?
Oh, what does it mean to me for an athlete to get it? I think it sort of goes back to accountability. When an athlete gets it, they see the whole picture. They recognize their privilege, but they also see the need for a voice or a fight elsewhere to stand up for others. They don't take for granted a moment when they're on top, right? When they're swimming well or doing well. They lift others up with them. I think it is it's literally seeing. It's opening your eyes and seeing the world. You know, I had a chance to the USOC before it turned to USOPC, but the USOC way back hired me to talk to teams about what it means to be an Olympian and, you know, everything from how to celebrate with the American flag, right? You put the stars and stripes in one hand and the stars in one hand and the stripes in the other. And then when you hold it up, it looks right. Don't drape it over you. It's not a piece of clothing and all this kind of stuff. But in that experience, I had the opportunity to speak to USA basketball men's team. And here I am looking out at a sea of millionaires, right? And they're not getting paid to play for this team. So what are they playing for? And I remember in this moment, really looking at a few of them and thinking, they get it. So what they got were the words that were coming out of my mouth. They absorbed them wholeheartedly. So I said, take this time and go and watch the other sports, because you're going to be watching some people who have a family at home and they're working two jobs to fulfill this dream that they have been working towards. If not just for the last 4 years, wholeheartedly, their entire lives. So take that in and recognize that they have literally given their blood, sweat, and tears to this moment in time. And it's not about money for them. There's no money in it, right? It's the beauty of the moment and the podium and the flag and the medal. And as I said before, all those people who played a part and that weight of that journey. Like, that's why the medal should weigh so much. And a few of those players, like, literally absorbed that moment. And that entire team that year went to every single sport they could get into to watch their teammates, other USA Olympians compete. They soaked up every single moment. And I've spoken to him since, and it by far is one of the greatest moments of their sporting career, really taking it in.
You inspire them to show up for their teammates.
Well, it was just, they were probably going to do it, right? But then when they did it, they saw these individuals and who they were, right? And how incredibly different, but also very similar. I mean, I think that a lot of these NBA players, if you said to them, hey, listen, we can only pay you, you know, the bare minimum, like what the average American makes, let's just say the very lowest $20,000 a year. Okay. That's what we can pay you, but you're going to win a world championship. I mean, I think that everyone, the goal is to win that world championship, right? To be the best at one point in your life. So it's never really, I mean, it is about money, and that does make you feel like, okay, I can take care of people and all of that. But at the core of it is this Olympic value of that moment in time and a really nice medal.
Well, I think you make a really important point there, which is that even if the athletes are making money, in order to succeed and make it to this level, you can't be in it just for the money. It has to be about something so much more than that.
Right. Exactly. And that's a common denominator. That's a common theme from an Olympian to a professional athlete.
Yeah. Well, I just have two more questions for you. One, you've been such a leader in the space for supporting athletes, bringing public attention to it, bringing public attention to Olympic sport with a really powerful perspective, again, of looking at the whole human being behind the athlete that put all of this time and has this why and this inspiration to get there. What is something that you have learned about leadership over the course of your whole career, not just as an athlete, that maybe marks an evolution in your thinking about being a leader?
I think to be a good leader, you have to be an exceptional listener. I have found that not exceptional leaders don't spend enough time listening. My dad always said, God gave you two ears and one mouth so that you didn't twice as much listening as speaking. And I do think it's a really good lesson to live by. I know there've been a lot of studies lately about how when you just are quiet, more quiet, it does send this message of not only listening, but this respect of leadership, being a good leader, right? Respecting everyone else and what they're saying. So yes, I think you have to be a very good listener. And by listening and equally hearing, I think you earn respect with the people that you're leading. I also think to be a very good leader, you have to be incredibly vulnerable. I work with this company called Team Aradery, and I lead these experiences with executives in business. And the title of it is, What If We All Wore Speedos to Work? And, right? So I think leaders, managers, CEOs, like the head honchos, need to get more comfortable openly being imperfect, accepting this idea of taking risks and being brave and being bold and thinking differently, knowing that it might not 100% work out the first time, but making mistakes and being faulty is totally normal. And that doesn't make you a bad employee. In fact, it bonds us, right? So when you have a leader who's vulnerable enough to say those things and to be that person, you're creating a culture and a true base of where you can grow as a group. And that point of growth is incredibly valuable. I don't know another way to get to that peeling away of layers and that point of growth, and that we're all in this together and none of us are perfect, but let's go work hard and have fun doing it. Right? As opposed to, I do everything great and everyone should listen to me and not speak. And I mean, that's not a leader. So leadership to me is, it's really frankly not rocket science. It's a lot of listening. It's a ton of decision-making. And obviously we've learned, you know, great appointing of people below them, but a vulnerability that seeps out into everyone else around you.
Oh, I love that. That's so powerful. And it's so, I think, so needed in so many spaces. My last question for you is to ask you about your new position with the USOPF, United mm-hmm. States Olympic and Paralympic Foundation. Talk to us about what you're doing with them.
This is a position that I'm so excited about. I was a part of help creating this position. Essentially, I love the Olympic rings so much. I mean, in 1984, when the Olympic Games were in LA, my dad was from LA. So he had it on his calendar to take us to the 84 games. He was Mr. USA, loved the Olympic rings. I mean, I was 11. I was pretty good at swimming, but he didn't see me as like the potential to be the Olympian. He just wanted to go to the Olympics. At that time, I wasn't loving swimming. So I quit. We go to the Olympic Games in LA. We drive down there in our Mazda 626. We got every ticket we could get our hands on. And I fell in love with the Olympic Games. And I called my friend on the way back at a payphone. And I said, I'm going back to swimming. That's it. And that sparked a dream to be an Olympian. And those are the feelings that I think a lot of us, my generation and maybe one generation below, have. We have that Olympian, right? And that moment. And then with that, it's like, who was I with when I was watching that moment? And then it becomes this like amazing emotional memory in your life of that Olympic moment. I think I got worried that the younger kids right now are steering away from having that moment. And I just wish it for everyone. I want everyone to be inspired by the beauty of the Olympic Games. It doesn't have to be an American athlete. It's the beauty of the last place finisher in the marathon and everybody waiting for him or her and cheering this person on, because that's Olympism. And so my role with the USOPF, which is the foundation of the Olympic movement, is to remind people that we are one of the only countries, one of the only Olympic federations that is not funded by our government. We don't want to be funded by our government. I think that would make it very complicated. But we are funded by private citizens and private companies that believe in our mission and want to be a part of that podium moment. And they truly are. So many people don't know this. I think the USOPF appreciates every dollar from a $5 donation to the giant donations that are funding mental health movements, that are funding technology. But the great thing for people to realize is the USOPF and the USOPC. So there's the USOPC, which is the Olympic Committee. And then there's the foundation, which helps fund all of the sports. Some sports have their own fundraising, but they all need funding from the foundation. And when money is coming from the foundation, we have an in-house auditor. And they audit every single dollar that's spent. So it all goes to the athlete in some way, shape, or form, whether it's actual sports training, whether it's the technology behind everything that they're using, from speed suits to training facilities and new ways to train, mental health, the travel, all of it, everything that encompasses how these athletes can get better and achieve their dreams. So yeah, I get to tell that story over and over again to people. And it's, I love it. I love the rings so very much. And I believe in the Olympic movement.
I love this. So to be clear, individuals can contribute to the foundation and help support these athletes. Is that right?
Yes. So the foundation didn't exist until 2012. And so before that, you would just donate to the USOPC, or, you know, several years ago, it was the USOC. So yeah, they would just donate directly to them. But now there's more accountability for the dollars. Where are they going? What's happening? Who gets what? That's why the foundation was created in 2012. And I like it because I just can stand here and say, oh, like, you should feel good. It's all going to the athletes. It's all earmarked and they have to, you know, answer for every dollar, which I think is really, really important.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's great. So what we'll make sure to do for those folks listening, if you're interested in supporting this foundation, which is obviously an incredibly worthy cause, we will make sure that we have a website and some information on where you can go to donate and support the foundation and support these amazing Olympic athletes and the future of our Olympic teams here in the USA. So
with that, thanks, Amber.
Thank you so much, Summer. On a personal note, I'm just so thrilled to be able to talk to you and meet you in person and thank you for all that you've done for me personally, for sport. And it's just been a joy to talk with you today. Thank you for taking the time.
My pleasure. You were wonderful. Thank you so much.
I can't thank Summer enough for joining us on the show. I love how she is so clear on the importance of remaining true to who you are as a person. It can be difficult to keep that bearing in the sea of comparison and questionable advice that we call the internet. She's living proof that it's possible. Thank you for joining us for today's episode. If you loved today's show, remember to subscribe and leave us a 5-star review. The Be a Good Wheel podcast is produced by our wizard behind the curtain, Maxine Philibong. Find all published episodes and sign up for our newsletter at beagoodwheel.com. You can also listen wherever you get your podcasts. Support for the show comes entirely from listeners like you. Support us on Ko-Fi and Patreon to get monthly Q&A episodes, official Be a Good Wheel merch, and more. You can submit questions for Q&A episodes at beagoodwheel.com. We encourage you to check out our page on Ko-Fi. Unlike Patreon, Ko-Fi doesn't take a fee, so 100% of your support goes to the show. Go to ko-fi.com/beagoodwheel. That's ko-fi.com, ko-fi.com/beagoodwheel. Learn more about how to support us at beagoodwheel.com/support. Until next time, thanks for listening, and thanks for being a good wheel.